Good afternoon from the University of Southern California, and welcome to From Where We Are from Annenberg Radio News for October 29th, 2015. I'm Carla Javier. But first, a news update with Sebastian Vega.
Los Angeles street vendors filed a lawsuit today against the LAPD and a business improvement district for what street vendors say is illegal confiscation of their property. Caitlin Plummer has more.
Los Angeles street vendors are asking the LAPD and the security guards who work for the Fashion District's Business Improvement District to stop seizing their property. Shayla Myers is a staff attorney with the Legal Aid Foundation of LA. She says these confiscations are illegal because the property is not being seized for any constitutional reason.
Hopefully the city and the business improvement districts will understand that low-income people have rights to their personal belongings just like everyone else, and they can't be taken without the process that the Constitution requires.
Aureliano Santiago is an ice cream vendor representing street vendors in the Fashion District. He says his property has been confiscated at least 20 times in the past 5 years. He keeps returning out of necessity.
Realmente regresamos a hacer lo mismo.
We keep going back to doing our business because that's what we rely on for to support our families. And we do this so we won't have to ask the government to pay to support us in a welfare system.
Santiago says LAPD officers also issue a $375 ticket on top of seizing his property. Santiago makes an average of $30 a day. LAPD and the Business Improvement District did not return our phone calls. Caitlin Plummer, Annenberg Radio News.
Delivery drivers for the new Amazon Prime Now service are suing Amazon.com. Workers say they're being wrongfully paid as independent contractors, even though they're treated like employees. Thibault Claris Gauthier has the story.
Drivers say they're paid at a flat rate of $11 an hour and are not paid overtime if they work more than 8 hours a day. They're also forced to absorb all work-related costs. They pay for their own gas, car insurance, and repairs. Beth Ross, an attorney representing the drivers, says Amazon profits by exploiting its workers. Sheryar Kouji is the director of the Campaign for Clean and Safe Ports. He says these workers are prepared for a fight.
Bulk of these workers are employed through a staffing agency at or close to minimum wage. So all these issues, these workers have been getting together to improve these conditions, calling on their boss. And in response, they've faced intimidation, retaliation. And so these workers are on their second unfair labor practice strike.
With the second strike underway, Kouji hopes the strike will push Amazon to treat its workers fairly. Thibault Claris Gauthier, Annenberg Radio News.
A Los Angeles jury today ruled that the Los Angeles Unified School District will have to pay $3 million each to two boys who were sexually abused by a third-grade teacher. Attorneys for the two boys had asked for more than $5 million each, while LA Unified offered to pay less than $500,000 to each boy. Vince Finaldi is an attorney who represented one of the boys. He calls the decision justice for the kids.
Well, we're very pleased with the verdict, and we're very glad that the jury was able to see through all the rhetoric of the school district to the actual truth of that. We're very happy about that.
The teacher, Paul Chappell III, is serving 25 years in prison after being convicted in 2012 of lewd acts with 13 children. Strong Santa Ana winds are fueling a fire in the Los Angeles Padres National Forest north of Santa Barbara County. The fire has spread across 70 acres of land. Hannah Vicente has an update.
The Santa Barbara Emergency Operations Center is monitoring the fire. Santa Barbara's Director of Emergency Management, Ryan Rockerbrand, says it's now considered a level one situation.
They are currently warnings at this time, not anything of a mandatory nature, but we're just preparing for if this fire does have a change in direction.
Rockerbrand says several fire districts are on the scene.
There is zero containment, but we have a significant number of folks out there in the field, crews working really hard to get. It's pretty heavy terrain to get at, but air attack has been successful. And
the area has seen mild fires the last few years. Rockerbrand encourages residents to be prepared for any fire that may break out around their home. That's good advice for fire areas all over Southern California. Hannah Vicente, Annenberg Radio News.
Bikers and pedestrians have a reason to be excited today. The federal government gave a grant to Los Angeles to turn a South LA railroad track into a bike path. The $15 million grant will cover nearly half the cost of the conversion. The track runs parallel to Slauson Avenue. It's already used by some 6,700 bikers and pedestrians a year. The conversion plans to include crosswalk markings, new signs, a new landscaping, and lighting to spruce up the 6.5-mile bike path. I'm Sebastian Vega, and it's 5 minutes after the hour.
When China implemented its one-child policy in 1979, it marked a historic effort to control its population. Today, China lifted that policy, and families can now have two children without fines or punishment. Brianna Feldot explores the impact of this dramatic change in the world's most populous nation.
China introduced the measure to control a rapidly growing population. With 1.4 billion people, it's the world's most populous country. Reports of forced and coerced abortion made the policy controversial from the get-go. An estimated 400 million births were prevented or terminated. China's rapidly aging population is putting a huge burden on single children to care for grandparents and parents. By 2040, those over 65 will nearly double to 30% of the population. Shui Xiaoxia, a visiting journalist from China, says reactions depend on different factors.
It depends on different communities and different group of people. For some group of people, like young couples, they would definitely be delighted to see this is happening in China because they can have a second child. But for some other elder couples, they probably feel a little bit sad and then disappointed because they lost the chance to have the second child.
Aya Zhang, a Chinese student at USC, said the new policy finally recognizes an old reality.
No, I think people are so excited about it. No one's going to follow the one-child policy anymore. And in fact, not many people have followed it. You know, like my boyfriend's brother has four children, and the fifth one is coming out this year.
The question going forward is whether this will create a baby boom. This is Brianna Feldot for Annenberg Radio News.
100 years ago, millions spoke Western Armenian dialect. That was before the Armenian Genocide, when a bloodied landscape was transformed into eastern Turkey. Harach Septedjian is waging a linguistic war in the Los Angeles classroom, facing down ambivalent, sometimes disrespectful teenagers. Andy Vasoyan has the story.
Harach Septedjian is an energetic man, with a sturdy jaw and salt-and-pepper hair. His name means eyes of fire in Armenian, the language he teaches at a small private high school in Los Angeles. Roughly 250 kids, and almost every one of them have been taught the Armenian language. Sepejan was my teacher, too, and that's partly why it was so hard to go back and find out, did he know that almost everything he was teaching would eventually be forgotten? I arrived just before his ninth grade Armenian language class starts. He introduced me to the students, and things start fine, but the boys in the back of the class throw a book bag. And Sepejan just goes off. If they're going to sit and joke, he says, there's no place for them in his class. That's pretty much how class used to go when I was a student. Sepejan approaches every lesson like a battle. But he definitely has something to lose. If Western Armenia is going to survive, kids like these will have to speak it. And that's why he desperately wants them to care. UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, has an endangered list for languages. Every day languages disappear, and Sepejan says that day is coming closer for Western Armenian. Sepejan's been teaching Armenian since he emigrated from Lebanon over a decade ago. When I was a student in 2006, he didn't speak a word of English. I wanted to know if 9 years later he'd picked up the language, so I gave him a pop quiz.
I can try.
Sepejan seems like he's thinking hard while speaking slow. It's a look I know well. I asked him if he recognized it from anywhere. He says it's the look someone has when they're thinking in one language and translating it into another. He sees it on the face of his students all the time. After a while, thinking of what to say in English, then translating it into Armenian gets frustrating. So many students only do it
in class. Because I don't talk Armenian with my friends. None of us do. When they say they do, they're lying.
Erica Sarangulian transferred to the school last year. Although she's now more involved with the Armenian community, she still has trouble keeping up her language skills. Another of Sepedjan's ninth graders, Michael Kulhaoglu, has been in the school for years. He really cares about maintaining his Armenian heritage. But when it comes to the language, he's not optimistic.
At most, like two or three people in this class are probably going to teach their kids Armenian.
He's just saying that now, but he's eventually going to talk to his kids in Armenian.
No, because right now you speak to your family in English, so why would you teach you? Like, it's going to be very difficult unless you send them to an Armenian school.
Although some of the other students disagree with Michael, any disagreement they have, they're having it in English. Nobody's more aware of that than Sepedjan, and he's not just thinking about the kids at the school. His two daughters are both in elementary, and they're also worrying him. He says that for now they still speak Armenian in front of him, but the second they're together, it's English all the way. They use English to greet friends, say they love their mom, and sometimes to berate people interviewing their dad. I asked the two sisters exactly what I did to get on their bad side.
No! Fatih, why is she mad at me?
I didn't mind getting called stinky, but I think their dad would have preferred if they called me hodads, the Armenian word. With the future of his work as an educator and as a father uncertain, I asked my old teacher how he has the strength to keep going. He says that for him, speaking Armenian and fighting for it is not a choice.
Andy Vasoyan, Annenberg Radio News.
Marijuana is a booming business in California, and it's only expected to get bigger. But despite its steady integration into mainstream culture, most cannabis dispensaries still operate on the fringes of the traditional business community. Helen Flourish explains how a new crop of entrepreneurs is changing that.
Medical marijuana use may be legal in California, but it's still a federal crime. That's why most dispensaries can't get bank accounts, leaving them with thousands of dollars in cash and no place to put it. But for Jared Yonker, their struggle is a big opportunity. Yonker is the founder of CMATES, a firm that helps cannabis companies come into compliance with state and municipal laws.
CMATES is Cannabis Management, Accounting, Tax, Employment, and Service. And specifically under CMATES, we also have Cannabis Accounting, which solely focuses on creating a service of tax compliance for the medical marijuana industry.
CMATES is just one example of several firms seeking to fill this niche in California. At the Cannabis World Congress and Business Expo in L.A. last month, startups showed off new and different ways to support the emerging industry. Cover Cannabis is an insurance provider catering exclusively to marijuana companies. The firm's vice president, Pat Grignon, has worked in insurance for many years.
Ultimately, there was a big need to be filled, and you know, there's not a lot of people that have access to or the expertise to do it, so that's where we come in.
Like banks, traditional insurance providers shy away from the marijuana industry for fear of violating federal law. Grignon explained that without insurance, dispensaries risk losing everything if their merchandise is lost or stolen. Mobile dispensaries or delivery services must also deal with the hazards of the road.
You put yourself at risk if you're operating your vehicle during or for the course of business, and you end up having an accident and them not paying out because of what you're doing.
California legalized medical marijuana in 1996. And about 10 years ago, dispensaries started popping up across the state. No one knows exactly how many there are, partly because without bank accounts or, in many cases, even business permits, they're difficult to track. The few banks that are willing to work with dispensaries require them to track every cent moving in or out of the business, a tactic to prevent money laundering. For dispensaries, this can be a time-consuming and expensive task. Jeff Foster is co-founder of a firm called Jane. His company has developed a system that puts kiosks inside dispensaries. These kiosks are like a high-tech ATM machine. These Jane machines, as they're called, take the place of traditional cash registers. Customers use them to peruse, select, and purchase medical marijuana, which they then pick up from store associates.
So that when the auditors come into the bank and say, these guys ran X amount of dollars through their account last month, we're able to show two separate reports of every single transaction that went through so that they know there was no illegal activity and that cash is legitimately placed in there.
Firms like CMates, Jane, and Cover Cannabis couldn't have picked a better time to bring their business savvy to the marijuana trade. In January 2018, the Medical Marijuana Regulation and Safety Act will take effect in California, bringing the first ever guidelines to the cannabis industry. Helen Flourish, Annenberg Radio News.
This week, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is meeting with representatives from over a dozen countries. They're trying to find a solution to the crisis in Syria, a way to end the Syrian civil war. Atul Singh is an Indian-born editor-in-chief and CEO of a nonprofit media organization called Fair Observer. Singh joined associate news editor Max Schwartz on Skype to discuss the Islamic State and Russian involvement in Syria.
Starting with the Islamic State, also known as ISIL or ISIS, from your perspective as a former member of the Special Ops Force in India, do you believe ISIL is beatable?
Absolutely. It's a fanatical organization which will eventually lose public support because the kind of vision they have for society is fundamentally inhuman. At some point, people will tire of them and will look for a more humane, a more tolerant, and a more open society. If we act wisely, they will lose faster. If we act unwisely, they will last a little longer. This is fundamentally an organization that is inhuman, that is raping, that is plundering, that is pillaging, that is destroying ancient heritage for all humanity, such as Palmyra. So there can be no acceptance of this organization.
The Russians, they make it seem like they're there for one reason, but it appears that they're only trying to support Bashar al-Assad.
But wait a minute. Everyone may make it out there for one reason. America made it out that it went to Iraq to promote democracy. In reality, it didn't. It didn't put in the troops on the ground, and it didn't do the needful. It was a monumental blunder. So the point is that the Russians are following their strategic imperative, which is to prop up Assad. If Assad goes, they lose their only ally in the Middle East. So they are going to kill everyone Assad dislikes to prop him up. Their strategic imperative is just to retain influence in that part of the world and distract everyone from Ukraine. The Russian empire is crumbling. They have to fight a rearguard action to keep that empire or memories of it alive. So Russians are playing a very cold, cynical, and bloody game.
Thank you very much for joining us in the hot seat today via Skype. It was a pleasure to have you on.
That was Fair Observer CEO Atul Singh speaking with Annenberg Media's Max Schwartz, host of the podcast Hot Seat. News stories about race don't always have to be about police brutality or economic disparities. NPR reporter Shireen Marisol Meraji writes about race for the show Code Switch. Her stories are about black skiers, the first ethnic bachelor, and a bisexual Iranian American, just to name a few. Maya Williams sat down with Meraji to talk about how people of color are represented in the media.
The skiing and, you know, black people skiing, it's something that you don't think of. It's almost like the stereotype of black people don't swim. But I feel like Code Switch is highlighting the other, but also bringing up how there's this sameness and this commonality.
You know, to be perfectly honest, that story, I was like, who's going to care about this? Honestly, I was like, okay, black people skiing. I mean, I feel like maybe in the 70s, that would be a big deal. So when I got out there and I was in Aspen before the National Brotherhood of Skiers came in, I was like, wow, this is the whitest place I have ever seen. Shockingly white and shockingly wealthy. I mean, it is the 1% to the extreme. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I was like, wow. And then the next day, there were 2,000 African-Americans out in Aspen. And I was like, this is a story. And there is a way to tell this story. And it isn't just, oh, look, black people ski.
Another story that it was a while ago, but you did one about Juan Pablo, the first ethnic bachelor. But someone you interviewed in that piece said something interesting, which is the way we are treated is a product of how we're perceived.
I feel like if you go not code switch, but a lot of the stories that we do about people of color have to do with like really hard-hitting issues like immigration or child poverty, these issues which paint a picture of people of color as poor, needy, uneducated, et cetera, et cetera. And the list goes on. And actually, no, there are African-American middle-class people who go to Aspen and ski, and we never talk about them. Why don't we ever talk about them? I think about that a lot, especially when I'm pitching stories like this, because I know people are going to be like, well, who cares? Like, why do we care about that? But I think these are important stories, yeah, too. I mean, they paint a full picture of what it means to be a person of color living in the United States. It's not all we're in struggling schools and we're poor. That's part of it. It's not all about inequality. That's part of it. You know, we're just doing regular things like going skiing.
You have a very diverse array of stories that you go for. What sort of draws you to something?
I think it's stereotype busting. If you go through all of those stories, every single one of those stories is busting a stereotype in some way. Desiree Akhavan, who is Iranian American, but then she's bisexual. Mm-hmm. Steven Yeun, who is the sex symbol from The Walking Dead, but he's Asian. I think that I am drawn to those types of stories. Maybe it's because I don't fit into a box, but I love, you know, taking these ideas that we have of people of color and just like exploding them.
That's what's so interesting to me about the Bachelor piece. On the surface, it's this sort of like fluffy, melodramatic TV show, but the power that it could have to, yeah, see someone of color fall in love on TV and be just like you and just like me, and it's not always about struggle and poverty, that sort of level of representation that's missing.
Yeah, why isn't there more of that? Why isn't there more of that? I don't get it. I wish I had the answer.
Shake your fist.
I think there's not more of that because we're not in positions of power when it comes to the networks, the main networks. We just are not in the executive suite. Well, Shonda Rhimes has figured it out,
yeah,
which is just do stories that we all love, stories about passion and love and intrigue,
yeah,
and sex and death and murder, and then just put brown people in there.
Yeah, it's in a way, I mean, it's sort of like normalizing otherness.
Also, are we just not running into each other enough in the world? Are we like resegregating or something so that only white people interact with other white people and only brown people are interacting with brown people? I'm just trying to understand why this is happening. I mean, the people in the executive suite, they must just see, yeah, other white people and live in neighborhoods with only white people. So that is their reality.
So one last question for you. When you go to the movies, when you're watching the news or watching television, what do you want to see?
I always want a compelling story, and I want a satisfying ending to that compelling story. I just want to leave feeling full. And of course, I want to see people, mm-hmm, that look like me and people who sound like me. But number one, I want a compelling story, and mm-hmm, I want the story to be well told. So that's what I'm looking for.
That was Shireen Marisol Meraji. Her stories can be heard on NPR. And you can hear the rest of her interview on Match Volume at annenbergradio.org. The Broads have been all over the news since the museum bearing their name opened in downtown Los Angeles last month. In the public eye, Eli Broad gets the lion's share of the attention. But behind closed doors, Donna Granada found that Edith might be the one to thank for LA's newest art destination.
In September, news agencies from all over the world came to Los Angeles to report on the opening of the Broad Museum. It was a warm fall day packed with activities, speeches, and tours. Toward the end of the press conference, Eli and Edith Broad headed to their offices within the museum. Three people accompanied them. I was one. Eli fielded many questions while Edith sat quietly by his side. I had a question, but mine was for her. Edie, I asked, is it true that you started this collection? That the interest with art began with you?
I was interested in art before, yeah, Eli was. I did it. Yeah. We had a good friend who had a beautiful art collection, and we were at his house, and Eli said to him, my wife likes this, and I don't know why.
My question caught them a bit off guard, almost as if stunned to have the attention turned to her, but also delighted.
He introduced us to dealers. Eli started looking at art with me and got interested, and he's a reader and he studied, and I wanted to have art in our home. And so that's how it got started. And then after we really had enough at the house, Eli didn't want to stop. And then it got out of hand. And then we couldn't have any more at home, and he thought, why not have a lending library of art for museums? So that way we can keep buying, and we can lend it, and other people can see it.
We want to share it with the broadest possible public here and elsewhere.
The Broad Museum's collection and the Art Foundation evolved from the Broad's personal collection. To date, the museum has made over 8,000 loans to over 500 museums worldwide through the Broad Art Foundation lending program. General admission to the Broad Museum is free. Advanced online reservations are available at thebroad.org. Ticket reservations are highly encouraged during this busy time after the museum's opening. Donna Granada, Annenberg Radio News.
If you've ever wondered about the origins of curious words and phrases, here's Ian Hurley with today's Root Source.
An infestation of costumes, jack-o'-lanterns, and pumpkin spice can only mean one thing. Halloween is upon us. The time to watch your favorite horror films and perfect your ghoulish shrieks. You can trace Halloween back to the Celts of 2,000 years ago. They celebrated the harvest on October 31st, before the seasons changed into an unforgiving and deadly winter, in a festival they called Samhain. They believed this time of year was when the line between living and dead blurred and spirits roamed the night. To appease the spirits, they lit bonfires, dressed in animal skins, and told each other's fortunes, sort of like a pagan Burning Man without the hallucinogens. After Christianity spread into Celtic lands, the church instituted a new holiday on November 1st to replace Samhain, called All Saints' Day, or in Middle English terms, All Hallows. Soon, the day before All Hallows became known as All Hallows' Eve, and eventually, what we've come to term it as, Halloween.
It's a spooky time of year with Halloween and Dia de los Muertos fast approaching. While Halloween is all about the costume and the sugar rush, Day of the Dead is about family and heritage. Whitney Ashton joined Catholic school kids at an East LA cemetery to learn more about the meaning of Dia de los Muertos.
We'll pray in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
About 200 students from Catholic schools in East LA took a field trip to nearby Calvary Cemetery.
It's important for the children to know the theological background.
That was Giovanni Perez with the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. Each of the five school groups built an altar inside the cemetery's mausoleum.
And so these altars are a beautiful representation and reminder that God is the Lord of life, and that God is the one who gives life to us and gives life after death.
After they got their theology lessons, the students got crafty with face paint. Ernesto Vega is also with the Archdiocese.
So when I paint the face of a kid, half as a skeleton and the other half as a natural, the way the kid is, I'm representing the two dimensions in our reality, the matter, you know, where we are, we have flesh, and the spirit world that exists right now with us.
The children made paper flowers and decorated sugar skulls and picture frames with photos of the deceased. Joshua Vivas, a fifth grader at Resurrection Catholic School, made a frame for his cousin.
I'm probably going to put my cousin because when I wasn't born, but my cousin died and he should be 18.
That is so sad. He should be 18.
The Dia de los Muertos celebration will continue on November 1st from 1 to 6 p.m. at Calvary Cemetery in L.A. Whitney Ashton, Annenberg Radio News.
I look like a big candy corn.
That's it. for From Where We Are. We had help today from Samira Jordan, Kate Dowd, Natalie Zhang, and Nooran Mahmood. Our board operator is Lexi McAvinci. Martha Daniel is our producer. And for all of us here at Annenberg Radio News, I'm Carla Javier. Thank you.